Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture with me, Robert Bounds. On the programme today, I've invited in the broadcaster and writer Kate Hutchinson and chief rock and pop critic for The Times, Will Hodgkinson, to talk us through some of their favourite new albums of 2020. And guess what? They said, yes, OK, I'll come in. They'll be taking turns to spin some tracks that you should be listening to over the next couple of months. And so, without any further ado, let's hear from them both. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, Hello.
Kate. Hi, Will.
Happy 2020.
Hello. Happy 2020. Great to have you here.
Thank
it's
you
not
very
too
much.
Late. It is too late to say Happy New Year, but I've done it anyway. OK, we're going to start with you. We're looking forward to the albums of 2020.
Well, I tell you what, I am doing, and this links in with Georgia's album, because I went to her album launch last night.
Oh,
and
nice.
And it was a roller skating. She did a sort of, it was at the roller rink in North London, and I'm not drinking. And her album is kind of all about her. It's called Seeking Thrills, but it's about seeking thrills of a different kind. And for me, that was definitely flying round at 100 miles per hour. You know, I'm very fast at skating. I just can't stop.
Right.
So you know, it's, that was very exciting for me.
Are these kind of old school roller skates? Were they roller blades? Was it a mixture of the two? You could freestyle on the night.
Not blades. Don't be crazy. I mean, we're talking four. We're talking two in a row.
Good.
Two.
Yeah.
We're talking, I mean, it was quite funny to see, you know, a lot of the music industry sort of waddling like penguins. And then there was me just cutting everybody up. Oh, sorry. Oh, you know, just sort of elbowing everyone out the way.
It's a good leveler, isn't it?
It is a really good leveler. And I think that's what a lot of the themes of this album and of what George has been up to in the last 3 years is all about. It's called Seeking Thrills. I mean, the album's full of incredibly wonderful sort of Chicago house and Detroit sort of electronic music touches. It's very ravey. It's very clubby. It's very Robin as well as sort of an influence. I think she's going for that sort of refined sort of dance pop sound. But it's not seeking thrills that you might associate with hedonism and with house music. She gave up drinking for 2 years. I think it was getting to a bit of a crisis point. And she really sort of locked herself away, taught herself songwriting, kind of, you know, was listening to lots of Joni Mitchell and this, that and the other, and figuring out, you know, the sort of crux of how you write a great song. And then putting ravey sort of beats and very euphoric sounds with that. So we're seeking thrills in a very sort of sober way. And I've been doing Dry January. So this all sort of somehow fits together.
I like the autobiographical nature of your association with this record. Should we have a clip? Should we let our listeners in on the secret? This is a clip of Georgia. And this is a cut from a track called About Work the Dance Floor.
I don't have much in terms of money.
Okay, it's Kate's choice. First off, that is Georgia from the album Seeking Thrills. That was called About Work, the Dance Floor. A lot of, maybe it's just the current state of pop, but that sounds really contemporary. And yet you can, as you said, name check all the things that are going into it.
Super contemporary.
All the ingredients.
And I think it's really interesting that it's connected. This track is really, really connected. I mean, she's an indie artist. She's ostensibly a drummer. I've actually picked two drummers for my choices for this time, Moses Boyd and Georgia. So she started off as a drummer. So she was a session drummer and then a producer. And her first record was signed to Domino Records, the home of Arctic Monkeys and Franz Ferdinand. You know, it's a traditionally indie label. And she was sort of making this sort of like MIA, sort of rapping, very percussive type sort of left field pop, I suppose. It was quite brash. And with this record, it sounds so realised. You know, it sounds so contemporary. It sounds so... It's really connected in an amazing way, and it's climbed up the Radio 1 A-list, also on the Radio 2 playlist.
Yeah.
So that's two quite different audiences. I'm pretty sure that Six Music are also, you know, into it. And so she's sort of nailed the sound that's managed to sort of bring together lots of different audiences. And I think a lot of that has to do with finding her voice. She's singing for the first time, really, on this record.
And she's super young, right?
I think she's actually late 20s.
Oh, is she?
Early 30s. Okay. That's super young, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll kind of, yeah, exactly. So all of us.
Why
in
look
this
at
studio.
Me?
Yeah. I don't know, I'm just looking for backup. I'm looking for backup here.
I'm getting worried now.
Sorry,
she,
Will.
She is young, but I think she's really kind of typical of this sort of new wave of artists who are doing everything themselves. You know, she's producing, you know, everything or co-producing everything herself. She's also co-producing, I think, with the Black Madonna. Very exciting DJ, one of the biggest kind of most recognisable DJs in the world, I would say, at the moment.
One of the weirdest, also, nights of Holly and I's life, sharing a taxi back from the club festival with Black Madonna to Turin Airport.
Wow.
No one had been to bed. Apart from Black Madonna, who slept in the taxi on the way back to the airport. Man,
like
that lady can snore.
DJ.
Yeah, like a professional DJ. That's a point of note. That's got nothing to do with this story.
So back to Georgia. I think people just really love that sort of euphoric, sort of strutty pop sound that Robin kind of really nailed with Dancing.
There's something sort of motoric about it. There's something endlessly, kind of relentlessly percussive about it. But then you've got these wonderful vocals sailing over the top of it.
Definitely.
It's a very nice place to be. It's seeking thrills of the kind of non-alcoholic, non-drug kind. Do albums made cleanly like that sound the same as ones that are made in the kind of old rock and roll kind of way of seeking different types of thrills? What do we think?
Oh, this is one of my favourite debates. Will, you've definitely got something.
I've got some opinions. I would say, on the whole, what happens is that, you know, if you're thinking of Exile on Main Street or any of the classic sort of druggy albums, a lot of the drugs are actually taken before they got into the studio. You know, it's the songwriting stage and the inspirational stage when you get into that strange, you know, state of mind. Having said all of that, you know, the Georgia album is fantastic. And, you know, the idea of healthy raving is a kind of new concept to me.
Yeah.
And I was listening to it, well, this is great. And actually, it's got the same spirit. It's definitely got the house elements that Kate was mentioning. And I also think it's got the disco thing of the sadness of the dance floor, which is that you know it's going to end.
Mm.
So it's got that kind of slightly, you know, it's got a very soulful voice. It's got that slightly melancholic quality. So I think that period of classic disco was very drug driven, mostly cocaine.
Yeah.
You know, which does give you a false thrill and then ends. And so, you know, and then she's made this album without it. So I think, yeah, it's not about the drugs. It's about the emotions maybe that the drugs create, but not the actual substance itself.
Also, I think, you know, she has taken drugs.
Yeah, sure
she's
she
talked about that. She's talked, you know, she's been to festivals. She's been out raving. She knows what that feeling is like. And she contrasted that sort of euphoria, quote unquote, with the euphoria of going sober raving. So she went to Berghain without taking any substances, stayed up all night, and really got to experience that in a way that I think very few people get to do, actually.
Colonel Kurtz only.
Yeah, so she's got an insight there, you know?
Yeah, and I suppose it is that way of channeling the experiences that you know you can have and doing it sober. Not that I'm saying, I mean, we're making this sound like this is some sort of self-help record.
You know,
I mean, it's such a joy thing. I know you reviewed it for The Times, and that turned me onto it. And you interviewed her for Q magazine in the UK.
Yeah.
So what is Georgia, how is she as an interviewee?
She is really fun. And the great thing about doing that piece was actually that she'd taken her mum with her to the gig. So I got sort of two Georgias, sort of, you know, I got her mum and her. I had two people with this sort of larger-than-life personalities, huge curly hair, and it was brilliant. Yeah, she's really down-to-earth Georgia. I mean, her dad is Neil Barnes from Left Field. She's grown up in an environment that was very, you know, bohemian, very ravey. She was going to Glastonbury when she was 9 years old. She has that kind of coolness that you get from, and without being, you know, she's not sort of showy offy about it at all. She's not showy off at all. She has that sort of down to earth quality that you only get when you've been brought up in that environment, I think.
The super cool Georgia, the album's called Seeking Thrills, as recommended by Kate Hutchinson. And how is Georgia's skating? Roller brackets.
She managed excellently. There was a brilliant moment where her and Lawrence Bell, the head of Domino Records, were holding hands, sort of wobbling around the roller rink together. Really good. But I would just like to say, last thing, is that I feel, in my opinion, that it's the first great record of the decade so far.
I definitely agree. I didn't think there was going to be anything really good to review in the first week of January. And I thought, I loved the Georgia album. I thought it was inspiring and just it's got a great spirit, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Well, we're going to move to you, and you've chosen Mac Miller.
Very surprisingly.
And Circles. Shall we get our listeners into the vibe first okay. with a clip? This is good news. There's a whole lot more for me waiting on the other side. I'm always wondering if it feels like summer. I know maybe I'm too late. I could make it there some other time. I'll finally discover. Gauzy stuff from
it
Mac
is.
Miller. Tell our listeners who he is, who he was.
Okay, well, Mac Miller died in 2018. He was going out with Ariana Grande for 2 years, and so he became very famous in the way that you do if two famous people get together. And he started out as a sort of bro of hip-hop. You know, his first hit was called Donald Trump, and it wasn't particularly anti-Donald Trump. It was basically saying, isn't it fantastic to be disgustingly wealthy? And, I was never a fan at all. I thought most of the stuff he did was just chiming in with what was going on anyway. He did an album before he died, which was called Swimming, and I didn't particularly like it. It just sounded like, you know, that time there's this trend for kind of Xanax, inspired hip hop, all very woozy and stuff. Then he died before he completed this album, which is called Circles. So A, not a fan. B, posthumous albums are always, you know, they're kind of a tasteless idea, really, because how can it not be a cash-in? And they always say, oh, it's what they would have wanted. Well, you know, they're not here to say, are they? So who knows? So the whole thing I just felt was bad taste and going to be terrible. And I ended up really liking it. And it was it's a very, very sad album. The music actually reminds me of something that a Las Vegas lounge band, you know, old men in Hawaiian shirts would come up with. Like, there's a Bon Tempe organ going through it and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Like the band at the end of Alias Smith and Jones.
Yes, a little bit like that. Or you know, basically the end of the pier.
Yeah.
You know, wherever, the end of whatever, you know, but definitely the kind of... And the lyrics are clear. I mean, now we know, you know, he died of a accidental drug overdose, and it was depressants, really, you know, and he was severely depressed. I mean, anyone who thinks they want to become famous should listen to this album and reconsider, because all of the songs are about feeling trapped, feeling that everybody just wants you to put on a good show and be optimistic, and they don't want to see the depressing side, you know, feeling that you are apologising the whole time and you don't know what you're apologising for, you know, kind of self-hatred, being a bit disgusted with yourself. And in amidst all this, he's done a cover version. One of my all-time favourite bands is a band called Love, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
And he's done a cover of Everybody's Gotta Live, which is a quite obscure solo song that Arthur Lee from Love did in the 70s. It's like, wow, this guy's actually got something. So I'm surprised at myself. You know, maybe I have my own prejudices about the guy. I think it's a really interesting album. It's really thoughtful. It's very, very sad, you know, especially given what happened. And actually, it's not, you know, he died almost 2 years ago. And it could be really, really tasteless. I remember after Amy Winehouse died, they scraped together this album called Lioness, and it was just awful. But this seems like a complete piece. And so his old producer, John Bryan, put all the work into finishing it. But I think most of it must have been done, because it sounds like it was.
And where are we musically? Starting out saying he was a bit of a hip-hop bro. I mean, the clip that we heard there, and how is that illustrative of the LP? It sounds kind of like he's jumping between genres. There's a bit of picking. It kind of sounds folky. It sounds not dissimilar to someone like Kurt Vile or Mac DeMarco.
Mac DeMarco is a good comparison. It's first of all, there's a band, so it's not samples. It's actually, you know, it's acoustic instruments. Apart from Everybody's Gotta Live, which is a kind of 70s style rocker, everything is low-key, downbeat. He's mumbling his words, which can be a little irritating. He sort of swallows his words, but, you know, it sort of somehow works. And then the music is, like I said, it is a bit sort of lounge band. It's got that, you know, which Mac DeMarco does as well. It's, you know, that kind of smooth but a little bit druggy and a little bit depressed and slow. But at the same time, it's got these nice little sweet melodies that pop in. So it's actually interesting music. It's definitely listenable. It's not unwelcoming.
I don't want to get stuck on just talking about artists and drugs, but it was an interesting thing you talk about, sort of Xanax inspired hip hop. I mean, we know about these, you know, the sleeping pills, the anti anxiety pills and stuff that the opioid epidemic in the US, which clearly affects music and genre and changes things in all sorts of ways. Is that a recognize? Is that a critical term? And is that a Hodgkinsonism, or is that a kind of subgenre?
It's a subgenre, but yeah. I think it reached a peak about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it got a lot of coverage. There are all these little kids who are tattooing their faces because, you know, it meant nothing to do that, and also it's a way of getting a lot of attention.
Yeah.
You know, in the social media world. A lot of, you know, people were dying very, very young. Mac Miller's now died. There's Lil Peep died. Yeah. He was one of the big stars of that scene. I mean, Mac Miller wasn't really a part of that. And that's why I didn't like the last album, because it felt like he was latching onto this weird, rather unhealthy scene that had developed. But he was, you know, his background, yeah, he's a hip-hop guy, basically. Yeah. Actually, a kind of poor little rich kid, you know, sort of fairly wealthy and... you know, like a lot of sort of rich American white kids, you know, was very enamored with hip hop. And it wasn't, I didn't really buy it before, but I thought this was a very honest album. So yeah, drugs was, clearly he had drug problems, but I think it wasn't so much the drug problems which we associated with rock and rollers. Yeah. It was this new wave of
downers,
which is very depressing, you know, that people are actually just taking things to just slow everything down and kind of block things out.
Well, thanks, Phil. Thanks for filling us in on Mac Miller. The album is called Circles, a surprise posthumous success story, if we can call it that. That is out on Warner Records. Kate, we're coming back to you with your second drummer of the programme, Moses Boyd. Let's have a bit of Only You. Okay, it's a kind of Only You, new from Moses Boyd, Kate's second choice. And as a way also to talk about jazz in the UK, we've heard so much about it the last couple of years.
Unsurprisingly, I'm coming on the show and talking about jazz once
more. I like
it.
Come on.
I thought, why ruin, you know, the...
As he spins around in his chair, looks at the camera and just goes, cool.
Well, there's a reason why, you know, I do always pick a jazz album to talk about, but there's a reason why I've picked this one, and I think you can hear from that clip. It doesn't sound like what you might think one of the new wave of UK jazz musicians would be sounding like. I think that when that whole kind of thing exploded 2 years ago, and I wrote a big piece on it for Observer New Review, Will, you wrote a big piece about it for The Times, it felt really exciting. It was a scene, it was a movement, it was people that all knew each other, there was, you know, radio shows and stations cropping up, labels, everything felt like a sort of new ecosystem was developing around it. And then people talked about, oh God, do you think it will continue? Do you think it's just a fad? Do you think it's a wave? And what excites me about Moses Boyd and the other artists that are coming through and releasing albums at the moment is that it transcends, I think, what that UK jazz label, what you might associate with that. Moses Boyd's record, this record, Stranger Than Fiction, it sounds to me like he's creating a new style of British pop music. Yes, of course, he's a drummer and you can hear the percussion and it's very sort of high in the mix, is at the forefront. And his rhythm, you know, it's all about his rhythm, but there's broken beat, club sounds, there's a bit of two-step, there's soul, there's even metal is one of the references. I mean, I can't say that I definitely heard that, but there's definitely some quite sort of darker sounds.
The album, and all those crazy time signatures are very metal, presumably. There's something of that kind of in there.
from avant jazz to math rock. math metal. Yeah, but I really feel that this record is very accomplished and has a real scope, has a real breadth to show him off as, you know, not just a drummer, but a producer, as a band leader, as an artist. It starts off really sort of jubilant and uplifting and you're like, yes, 2020, okay, this is great, there's Afrobeat.
Yeah. I love your 2020, infectious 2020
I'm
optimism.
I'm so into 2020, right? Guys. Yeah. I'm so into it. It starts off really uplifting and then it gets darker and it gets shadier, and there's a great artist whose name I'm going to pronounce pronouncing correctly, Abong Jayar, who comes in on vocals for this track called, where is the name of it? Dancing in the Dark, is that the one? Yeah, and it sounds like sort of, you know, in the lineage of Massive Attack or something.
Yeah, yeah. That, I mean, that track's like from that we chose Only You there, that's got Massive Attack paw prints on it, hasn't it?
In the way, like, it doesn't sound like trip hop, but it's in that sort of vein of really sort of moving, interesting, you know, fresh as a lemon wedge, British music, dance music, or electronic music. And yeah, I mean, I listened to that record and honestly, I felt really blown away by it. You know, I feel like when we talk about jazz, we write about jazz and we have to present it as part of something. You know, it's this collective of musicians, it's this movement, it's this wave. And what I'm really excited about with the Moses album and other albums of that ilk is that I think we need to start talking about them as individual artists rather than, you know, continually perpetuating this idea of this scene. And it is a scene, which is great. I mean, no wonder we're excited about it because it's something real and it's something grassroots and it's something DIY. But this record, yeah, definitely feels like a step up.
Is this sort of stuff still kind of searching for that feeling of liveness, or do we want some, do we want a production veneer on it? Do we want it to be a different thing than how you'd see Moses Boyd live? You know, Chewbacca Hutchings, Sons of Kemet, Binker Golding, these people. Are we looking for the reproduction of the great live jazz vibe, or do we want jazz records to be a different thing, like rock albums of a certain era were? They were different to the live experience.
I don't think it necessarily matters, you know.
Okay. I mean, the Moses Boyd there sounded like a real record. It sounded like a produced thing that would maybe be difficult to reproduce. Live.
Well, I think going back to the fact of the virtuosity which they've got to, it means that they can do an album like that, and then you can go and see them. They might do something completely different, but it's still coming from them, and it's still coming from their ideas. And so, you know, it's a bit like, I don't know, what's a classic produced rock album? Rumours by Fleetwood Mac. You know, that's the most produced album going.
Yeah.
We all love it. Mm. You know, it doesn't, you know, you still go and see Fleetwood Mac and they can make a few mistakes. It doesn't really matter if, you know, Go Your Own Way isn't perfect.
Yeah. But we'll see that happen. I mean, this is still a very kind of, you know, it's a nascent movement or whatever. And so I think the artists, I get the impression is that they really want to, again, establish themselves as artists, establish what they can do. And then maybe, yeah, in 2 years' time, there'll be a Moses Boyd live experience album. In fact, actually, I think his release before this might have been geared more towards that sort of live sounding thing. But this is just the beginning.
That sounds like a great final note on Moses Boyd. We heard Only You. It's from the album called Dark Matter, and that is out on February the 14th. Will, finally we're coming to you and Bill Fay.
Yes, Bill Fay was a guy who put out a couple of albums in 70 and 71, which got nice reviews, and everyone said, oh, aren't they wonderful? And they sold about 3 copies each. So then off he went. He got sacked from his record label, and he became a gardener for the next 40 years, and thought, okay, that's fine, that's my life now. He never stopped making music, you know, and, you know, just because you're not putting out albums doesn't mean you can't play piano, he's a musician and he enjoyed it and it was central to him, but it wasn't what he was doing for a living. He didn't perform live at all or anything. Anyway, those two albums slowly got rediscovered and slowly became, they sort of fall into the Nick Drake category. I mean, I think that his voice really reminds me of Robert Wyatt. Mm-hmm. And although Robert Wyatt was
very particular,
but very sad. You know, he's got that sadness and a kind of yearning quality and a sort of aged masculine quality, but also very, very, you know, sort of tender. They got discovered. I think Nick Cave became a fan. Very, you know, a few sort of reasonably well-known people started bigging him up. And then he had this incredible second act, which I think started in about 2012. He put out his third album after only a 40-year gap, 42 years later. And now he's on to his fifth. And it's all very rustic. It's got a kind of semi-apocalyptic feel. It's all about the ecology. But at the same time, it's got an optimistic element, and probably because he's been a gardener all this time, he's not just going to say, oh, it's terrible, it's all ending.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually seeing how nature works.
He's been deep in nature. Yeah.
He's been deep in nature.
Well, I don't think anything can whet our appetites more for a little clip of Bill Fay. This is called Filled With Your Wonder once again.
When I heard you doing laughing in the rain, with wonder once again.
That's quite beautiful.
It's lovely, yeah. Very simple.
Yeah, yeah, but wonderful stuff. You're right, that's such a particular voice and delivery.
Yeah, the voice, it's one of those voices I can see a lot of people not liking it, but it just gets to me. You know, there's certain voices that just kind of affect you.
Yeah.
Robert Wyatt does as well, especially that song Last I Am Free, which I think was a Cocteau Twins song originally. But it's like that. And he's an interesting guy. I mean, I suppose he falls into the kind of acid folk category, hippie folk. But it doesn't quite fit into that, because that tends to have a sort of slight element of camp, or at least a sort of mysticism, whereas he's much more, it's fairly straightforward.
Isn't it got its own genre now, which is sort of, forgotten, ye olde forgotten, legendary dusty icons or something?
Yeah, well, you're talking my language. I mean,
this is, yeah.
There is a whole sort of,
there is a whole genre.
A huge trend for this, isn't there, rediscovering.
Well, also a huge
people.
Industry. So a friend of mine does a label, which I'm sure you know, Light in the Attic. And that's basically what they do. They find these records which didn't get their dues first time round, and then put these very nice reissues out. And, I'm a sucker for that. I am a journalist, and I love a story. So Light in the Attic did a guy called Jim Sullivan, who used to play in a bar called The Raft in Malibu, and Lee Marvin and all these cool guys used to come and see him. And he went off after making a couple of albums. He disappeared into the desert, and they've never found him. They found his car. I mean, he must have died out in the desert, but they found his car and a guitar, and he's driving to Nashville from LA.
Doesn't it make the listening to it that much more delicious?
Yeah,
very,
I mean,
enigmatic.
I love stories like that. Yeah. I can't help it. But I was thinking about this the other day. I don't think there's anything wrong with, when people say, oh, it's just about the music. For me, it's not just about the music. It's about everything.
Yeah.
It's about the world. I don't think it should necessarily be separated culturally from all these things. I think it's part of it.
But I think that there's almost like this expectation now that there has to be this kind of this enigmatic story of finding, this person in the wilderness. It's the Orson Tape from Africa searching out at a CAC for 8 years after finding a tape of his in a Ghanaian market. And so actually there's a great story, and I'm going to tell it wrong, with Analog Africa, who do a lot of reissues of interesting forgotten lost genres, and they basically made up a story to see who would fall for it. And it was about,
what was the story?
It was the Moog that washes up on the island of Cape Verde or something in the 60s, which is, the key was before, I think, the
before
Moog, sorry,
invented.
The Moog was invented, but various journalists picked up on this story, but they were sort of...
Sounds like it's a Mighty Boosh storyline.
Exactly,
well.
But they were doing a sort of ha-ha at this kind of hunger that we have for this renewed hunger that we have for the searching for Sugar Man kind of effect, which can also be with genres, not just with musicians. I'm fascinated by all of it.
Yeah, I think you listen to, I love Vashti Bunyan, you listen to those records differently because you know that she kind of went off for 40 years and lived in a remote cottage and couldn't handle the 60s, and it's a romantic thing when you hear these voices again, when they make a new record. It's wonderful.
But they've got to be good. There are those records out there which just aren't very good, with the reissues, and you think, and there's some story attached, and you listen to it, it's like, yeah, but...
I think it's more bittersweet, though, when it comes to women of a certain age, with Vashti Bunyan, with Suzanne Tiani, women who were sort of perhaps marginalised at the time. Mm. When they came back and their stories refocused and reevaluated, that's when I think it's really special, and it's given the sort of credence that it deserved the first time round.
You're listening to the Mojo podcast.
Well, fair enough, isn't it? It's the Bill Fay world. Yeah. I mean, Vashti Bunyan.
Bill Fay, by the way, I love that. That sounds absolutely stunning.
It's lovely.
All of these four things I shall check out.
Gorgeous
we should
voice.
Say before we go, that was, we heard a clip of Bill Fay there. The track was called Filled With Your Wonder Once Again, and that is from Countless Branches by Bill Fay, and it's out now on Dead Oceans. Thank you very much, Will and Kate, for your wonderful choices. What a lot of rich texture you brought to your choices as well. Much further reading, hopefully, for our listeners. That brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you to my guests, Kate Hutchinson and Will Hodgkinson, and to my producer, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.